has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're proud of our breeding program, the best in North America. But we're also proud to be leaders in this industry. The PA Horse Breeders Association is funding cutting-edge research at Penn Vet to detect gene doping in thoroughbreds. And we endorse the SAFE Act to help protect the most vulnerable horses. Plus, we're pleased to support the aftercare programs set up by our horsemen's groups. Just a few of the reasons why you should join us in Pennsylvania, the premier place to breed and race.
At the Races with Steve Wick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Wick.
We're back, and I may have a little problem here with my hand that I was printing. I wanted to print out the plays from the weekend, and it says media jam, and I got my hand stuck in the printer. Johnny, you may hear the paramedics here in a minute. Okay, there we go. Oh my God. Johnny!
Stevie, you okay?
Yeah, I think so. This is different. This printer, it's different from the one I always had. So it's the first time I've tried to extricate paper, and I won't make that mistake again. It's got kind of a narrow opening. I literally could not get my hand out.
I'm envisioning one of those movies where good thing you weren't wearing a tie, like when the tie gets caught in it.
Yeah. And now it's now okay. So I may have a printing issue. Johnny, how was your weekend? If you were listening, I was speculating that at the beginning of the show I talked about how you had approached. You had absolutely given in to Todd's ability to get horses ready for Belmont. But I think like me and I like Nest, I think you came away empty-handed, right?
Well, certainly came away empty-handed in the super sector. I put that ticket together. I thought I originally thought, look, if you're going to get Nest, I thought would get a little play, and I thought that Mo Donegal certainly would get play, and then obviously. The one horse is going to get play, we the people. So it's like, well, how are you going to put this together so that it maybe comes back, with a little juice to it? But I didn't see Skippy Longstocking hanging around like that. And that's where I tripped up. But I thought Mo Donegal was the horse to beat. And I thought Ness was the one to beat him. And so, you know, the Exacta looked pretty good at the point where, you know, they kind of backed off of We the People. I was a little puzzled by that. I haven't heard you talk about that today, whether you were puzzled by it at all.
You mean the pricing? You mean the way because there was obviously a large influx of money at a certain point early in the day, and it that included Rich Strike coming down from the overnight odds. And so, you know, for those that haven't had a chance to look at the chart, 5-2, you know, when Mo Donegal became the favorite, I kind of felt personally, Johnny, like a chicken in a pot. I thought that was a real clear message, and I did not have him prominently enough. You know,
by the way, an asterisk on this moment right now. That's another pitfall of the multi-leg wagers. You don't get to see that tote board, and when you looked at that tote board, you went, "Oh yeah, okay, yeah,
exactly."
They know, and you know, I think this tote board was a pretty good example of how it can sometimes talk to you. The fact that We the People was, you know, here's the horse. excuse me, on paper, oh, certainly not as accomplished as his foes, but figured to be, if not the only speed, certainly controlling speed, which it turns out he ended up being. But going in, he looked like the controlling speed, and they often do well in the Belmont Stakes. So there were reasons to think that he would be 2-1, just as Morning Linemaker made him 2-1. Okay, if he goes to 5-2, okay, I get that. But he had drifted so far. I think at one point I remember seeing him at 5-1, maybe. And when you look, it's not always correct. There's nothing in this game that's 100%. That you could just tell yourself right off the bat. Nothing works all the time. But when you see a horse like that, who on paper figures to have a distinct advantage early, and he's just being ignored, man, that tells you something right away. For whatever reason, I don't know how, it's like we laughed last week, trainer John Papalardo used to say, that board, it's just lights and circuits and it knows everything. How does it know? Oh, it knows. You know, it knows. Anyway, so, and also, Rich Strike ended up going four 10-1, which is about, I think he was 4-1 in the morning line, if I remember correctly. And We the People went down to almost 4-1. But that told you something, I think.
Well, here's the numbers. Mo Donegal was 260. We the People 390, Rich Strike 410, Nest 530, then up to 770 for Creative Minister, 870 for Barber Road, 1180 Skippy Longstocking, and 1460 Golden Glider.
Yeah. So the multi-leg wagers and stuff on the day. Look, there are plenty of wagering opportunities. I heard and understand all the clamoring and hand-wringing about short fields. By the way, if you go back and look at historical charts, you know, I think we're... Look, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We have a problem with short fields right now on a daily basis across the breadth of racing. That's just the case right now. We have diminished fall crops. There are many reasons. That's a whole other conversation. But when you look at stakes races, you look at charts of historical stakes races, it is not uncommon for them to be short fields. If you look back in history, you know, I always thought that, oh, the world was so much better back in the 70s when I fell in head over heels with horse racing. But we had our short fields back then, too. What I think part of what happens is, in these stakes races, when you get horses that, one or two horses in a race that guys can't think, they think they can't beat, they don't want to waste an effort trying to beat them, so they don't run, and you end up with a short field. Well, when you bring these stakes races into one day, there's a chance that that's going to happen several times on your card. Because now you've got one or two horses that look like world beaters. Everybody's ducking them. And now you've got all these stakes races jammed on one card. You could have a few short fields on your card. That's a drawback. Now, talent-wise, well, we saw some... there's no question we saw some outstanding horses run. And if you're a fan of the sport from just the fan side of it, not the betting side of it, it was a tremendous couple days, you know. You saw some great racing. But if you're looking to make a wager, you have to find ways to string winners together or punch an exacta. Or, you know, as you said earlier, if you press your opinions so that you have a ticket, instead of buying a large ticket that maybe costs, you know, five times your normal ticket, spreading out, trying to cover all the bases, just single a couple races and then get that ticket 10 times. You know, as you mentioned earlier, and you mentioned Nick Cameron talks about it. Punch that ticket. Punch your opinion so that when you're right, you collect. And try and keep the spreading down. Now, if you can work, Tribuvin. Tribuvin. If you can work him at 19-1, a Chad Brown, or, you know, speed horse, and you get the other speed horse to break slowly, even though Tribuvin's probably going to the front anyway, if you can get that to happen, bingo, you know. So I think that's what you have to do in these big days where there are some short fields. Some, as they're called, prohibitive favorites. They're called prohibitive because you can't bet them to win. You're not going to get much money back. You have to bet a lot to make a little, and that's always a negative. But in this day and age now, and I think Belmont, you know, really pushed the envelope and said, here, we're going to, and following the lead of Churchill, we're going to give you all these wagers, a two-day this and a $3 that, a $2 that. They're playing with the minimums, and they're experimenting with different types of wagers over different, same types but over different days. They're stringing all stakes things together. You know, it's not like you don't have any options. You have plenty of options. You just have to be smart about it. You have to look at your bankroll and say where, and then do your handicapping. And then look at your bankroll and say, where do I want to attack this? You can't play everything. If you play everything, the chances that you're going to lose are pretty good. It's just a tough game. You have to have respect for the game and how tough it is. But when these racetracks give you so many options, which I think is great, just like in sports wagering where they give you, look, laying 11 to win 10 on picking the winner of the game, yeah, okay. But then you've got the over-under. You've got how many points this guy's going to score, and you can parlay these things together, and how many rebounds this guy's going to get. But you start to look at all the options. Yeah, put them up. Why not? Let people, you know, and then as a player, I have to have self-control. Can't play them all. I have to pick my spots. And then pick the things you like, and then punch it. You know, if you thought that Mo Donegal was a single, you could find a way around the Belmont Stakes, any number of ways. There were options to make money. So, you know, people complained about the short fields, and we all don't like short fields, but it's not really new. There have been short fields in the past.
Well, and you know, the question you could ask yourself, and our friend John, I don't know if he wants publicity on this or not, but I mean, for instance, he actually hit that early pick five that I mentioned, and got a quick flash on that ticket. He hit it 10 times. He hit it for $20. So, you know, there's a $17,000 hit on a $160 ticket. So I actually had a few specifics that I thought were just, you know, places to go ahead and stand. I mean, Jack Christopher wasn't getting beat. I didn't think Regal Glory was getting beat. I was a little, I'll tell you one thing that did hurt probably a lot of people's plays. I didn't think Echo Zulu was beating Matarea. You know, even if she had run, actually, I thought Matarea had a real advantage in that spot. So, I mean, I was going to use both, Matarea a little heavier, but that was a spot. You know, I had made the mental commitment to, you know, Regal Glory as a single over Speak of the Devil. I knew I was going to need to use a few in the Brooklyn. Jack Christopher gave you that opportunity. I actually got a little lucky because Clairiere, I did not use Malathat as anything better than a C. Casa Creed was my top pick in the Jiper, so that helped. I used a few, though. I wanted to be covered. Flightline, I ended up singling Johnny. And as I mentioned, when it came to Tribhuvan was like a C-plus for me, and on that last pick five, I used Tribhuvan equally with five others. I used six horses in the singling flight line. Then I went six deep in the Manhattan, five deep in the Belmont to catch Modonegal, who was sort of my fifth horse. I singled Al's, you know, Al's Rocket was going to have to fall down to lose that 12th race. And then I used four in the nightcap, Palace Gossip, and actually was a little bit fortunate there too, because I didn't have the horse that dueled with Palace Gossip to the wire. So, you know, the thing to do is not say, oh, this was a lousy day of racing from a betting perspective. The thing to do is to go back and look at it and understand where you could have done what John did, for instance, to make $17,000. Unbelievable. Got 100-1, essentially, on a $160 ticket. So just learn from this and be ready the next time.
Yeah, and there's one more point that, you know, I know so many things in the betting part of the game I know are wrong, but I still do them. I know they're not the optimum way to play, but I still play that way. Old habits, maybe foolishness. It's a fear of getting knocked out. And what I'm specifically referring to is, for example, a race like, let's say, the Met Mile, when you have Flight Line and you have Speaker's Corner. Too clear, you know, you're either here or there. Now, I mean, this may not be the greatest example, but if you look at the race and say, well, it's these two. Well, when you're playing it like pick fives and pick sixes, those are the kind of races where you need to say it's one. It's not two, it's one. And you need to make a choice. You know? Now, if you feel like you can't make a choice, that's another story. If you think two will lock up the race, okay, I get that. But in the long run, making a stand saying one here gives you so much, gives your ticket so much more strength where you have to go deep in other legs. It gives you such an opportunity to really have a robust, strong ticket, or to buy that ticket, you know, 10 times like John did. Well, you know, singles are so powerful, and when you and the point is that when you're in a race where it looks like it's two horses, boy, if you can separate them, do it, you know, and that makes such a difference when you add up what that ticket costs, the single instead of the double, and their short prices. You know, you mentioned a couple races where you made that kind of decision. And they were, you know, their short prices are a race like with Jack Christopher. That's a single, right? That's just a single. That gives so much strength to your ticket. Look, do I do it all the time? Do I follow my own advice? No. But people who know ticket construction way better than I do and are better bettors, as they would say, that's what they do. And that's what I try and work toward, to get better at constructing tickets so that you're not doubling a ticket when you're just afraid of a horse. You don't really like the other, you know, you like this, you like Flightline better than Speaker's Corner, but, well, if anybody's going to beat him, it's going to be this one. Well, that's not really the thing to do. The thing to do is to stand your ground, make your pick, gives your ticket more strength. Yeah, when Speaker's Corner wins on the odd occasion and you get knocked out, you know, you just have to move on, turn the page. But you have to build better tickets, stronger tickets. That makes sense? I don't know if I explained it right.
No, of course it does. And you know, that's... this continues to be the most challenging part of the exercise is, you know, because not only do you have to make that decision, those decisions on who you might find vulnerable, but then you still have to, I mean, let's say in the case, for instance, of the late action, you still have to conceive of Tribhuvan being able to win that way, and frankly, I mean that's exactly how I, you know, was able to hit that $3 pick three, the turf pick three, and hit that last pick five, was to have Tribhuvan as at least a C, was a C in the pick three, in the $3 pick three, and was an A when it came to that last pick five. And you know, then you're trading off of a Flightline. You're turning Flightline into, you know, that kind of a value. For instance, here $447 essentially on the back of Flightline on a $60 ticket. So yeah. You know, 8-1. Exactly. You turned a 2-5 into an 8-1.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the overriding point is the opportunities are there, even on days with short fields. And look, we all love the big day. I mean, I certainly do it. You know, the Derby Day, Preakness Day, Belmont Day, Travers Day, Breeders' Cup Day. You could add some other days that are big days nationally, locally more, but those are the signposts for the sport, and those are days that you really are excited to play, because those are days where, if you're correct, the pools are so big, you can make money. But you've got it, and this is the final thing that I'd advise here is, try and spend as much time making your tickets or planning your wagering strategy as you do handicapping the races. And I know that's crazy, because we spend most, if you're like me, spend most of your time, the vast majority of the time, handicapping the races. Well, when you're done your run through, especially on big days where you have a lot of options, stop and go back and say, what's the best? Where are my opinions? And then press those opinions and build your tickets in opportunity, in wagers where they fit how you see the races. And I'm gonna say something that I really found helpful is, I can't remember who put it on Twitter. I can't remember how I saw it on Twitter, but it looked like it was produced by Belmont Park, by Naira, and it was a one sheet that went race by race, kind of listed all the wagering opportunities for the 2 days and when it started. You know what I'm referring to?
Yeah, sure.
You might have sent it out. Well, not just on the racing form or whatever you use, where it may say, you know, what wagers are in that race. But here's an actual one page, or might have even been two page. I think it was one page, a one page sheet outlining the opportunities for the day or the days, the 2 days. Or that I think racetracks ought to do, organizations ought to do more often to give players, you know, a clear view, because we have a general idea that if there's a pick five, it's the last five races. We have a general idea if it's a pick six, it's the last six races. That generally works. That'll get us by. That'll get us in roughly the right position. But there are places where a pick five does not start in the first race. There's not one offered. Or maybe it starts in the second race. And when you are offering two-day wagers, you've got to promote them and make them clear to people beforehand so that everyone knows what's going on. Or if you have a $3 wager or a $2 wager instead of a 50-cent minimum, make it clear. Let's get the word out, because I think these are great. I think these are fantastic. I don't even want to say innovations, but fantastic new ways for us to play. They're being done mostly on big days now, and if they end up being only big days, that's fine. But maybe some racetracks ought to take a look at this stuff and say, hey, maybe we can offer our customers different options for wagering, and maybe that will encourage people to wager more, which is kind of the object if you're running it, if you're running a gambling game. So anyway, I spend time figuring out your wagers as much as you do handicapping, because it really is, when you're building that ticket, it's critically important. Whatever you're doing, if you're doing it horizontal or vertical, you really have to say, where do I see this horse? Do I see this horse winning? Not very often. Maybe outside shot. Do I see this horse winning? Yes, probably. Well, your tickets, when you build them, you should reflect those opinions. And look, this is nothing new that I come up with. I didn't come up with this. This is, you know, people have been preaching this for a long time. It's very difficult as a horse player to get yourself to do it. But spend a little more time thinking about your wagers like you do your handicap.
Well, that's very similar to... And basically is just another expression of what we went over when you laid out going back to Derby and explaining your, you know, your methodology. And one thing, and you probably have just seen that I put up the multi-race, multi-day wager results that was put out by Joe Longo. Thanks to Joe. You know, you mentioned putting out information, Johnny. We had Joe Longo on Friday to kick off the weekend preview, and we went through all of those. One of the things to look at here and to maybe reevaluate, because I did put together plays, and I did bet the very simple doubles. And in retrospect, the doubles, the doubles didn't exactly offer the kind of opportunity you may have speculated and considered. I mean, in fact, let's go over those for a second. The Philly and Mayer double, which was the Intercontinental and the Ogden Phipps, paid $32.70, Caraval and Clairier. And I whiffed on Caraval. I just didn't. I don't know. So I that one I completely botched. But $32.75 actually was not. That was not bad. The sprint double, which was Jackie's Warrior and Casa Creed, paid $8.60. And of course, you know, Jackie was going to depress that no matter what happened. I haven't asked Lee. I am curious now. I should ask Lee Einsiedler how many times he hit that. The New York Met double, which is kind of cutely named when we realize Rapoli's involvement on the weekend. The New York Met double on Bleecker Street. And she was terrific. She's really good. And Bleecker Street to Flight Line paid $7.50. The Gold Cup, this was, of course, Fearless, who I had kind of down the pecking order. I had Fearless on all the plays on in the Brooklyn, but only as a B. Fearless to, or excuse me, I take that back. We're talking about, not Fearless, we're talking about Loft. I hit this. This paid $12 with Loft and what's his name, and Mo Donegal. And the last double was the Met Mile to Belmont, which, frankly, I didn't even put a play in for this. I thought this was... I don't know. I don't know why. I just didn't think that it was that big of an opportunity. So I think those were... Yeah.
You skipped a wager?
I did skip. I skipped a couple, actually. There were a couple things. There were a couple I skipped.
You know, I was at the track one day, and the guy next to me said, who do you like in this race? I said, I'm not going to play this race. He said, you're passing the race. I said, yeah. He said, you know, they'll kick you out of here if they catch you doing that.
Well, did you play any of those doubles?
No.
How about the pick four, the pick six?
Yeah, I chased that stuff. I was kind of a up and down kind of weekend. You know, it wasn't... wasn't a home run, but it wasn't a strikeout. You know, it was probably a line drive into the gap that I might have got thrown out at second, I think, by missing the superfecta in the Belmont. Because just to shift gears on you, to get back to the Belmont and the superfecta, in my mind, I thought Mo Donegal and Nest were both, I thought either of those could win. I really did. And it turns out, by the running of the race, yeah, that maybe, as you mentioned earlier, if Nest, things had gone a little bit differently, it would have been closer for sure. I'm not sure she would have beat him, but it would have been close. So I thought those two were the A's. And then, you know, I thought that we the people would have a pace advantage. And maybe, you know, in a certain percentage of the time, steal it. Maybe if he could go that far and be sharp, and maybe. So I put in a, you know, like a small ticket with him on top, with Nest and Mo Donegal second, just in case he was able to steal it. There's a case where if you're doing things correctly, you probably should have never made that ticket, you know, because what is your opinion of the race? Your opinion is Mo Donegal and Ness. so why are you making another ticket with We the People? Well, because I think that maybe he might, well, then, you know, you're trying to cover yourself. And we do that so often. We try to cover ourselves by putting, well, turns out he went off at, turns out We the People went off at almost 4-1. But he was 2-1 on the morning line, and I don't think many people thought he'd be 4-1. I certainly did not. And that's the only opinion I can really rely on, is my own. I didn't think he'd be 4-1. I thought people would play him. But I didn't like him as much as the other two, so why did I make the second ticket? Why didn't I instead follow my opinion, which said these two are A's. I'm going to add We the People and make those three B's. And then after that, yeah, maybe third and fourth, you don't really know. So put them all in there, and you come away with a nice superfecta. Yeah, pretty good superfecta for an 8-horse field with a 5-2 shot winning, right? Didn't you think?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, but I wasted money because I was afraid of We the People a little bit, and I created this other ticket that made my first ticket weaker. You know, you've got to have your opinions and then bet your opinion. If you're wrong, you're wrong. It's not the first time you've been wrong. It's not going to be, if you play this game, you're going to be wrong a lot. It's when you're right, be really great. You know, stand behind your what you feel, how you see the race. Stand behind that. Because when you're right, you'll get paid. And when you're not right, don't make a ticket with a 2-1 shot on top that's stacking your bankroll. You know, it's just, you're just trying to cover yourself. So in analyzing my own plays, I say, dummy, look what you did. Stoop, that's a bad play. Okay, now I know. I'll try and do better next time. But that goes back to my earlier point. Of when you're making your tickets, I was afraid of We the People stealing a race. Well, you know, that's not your, what's your real opinion? My real opinion is, no, he's not going to win. So put him second, put him third, put him fourth. Stick with who you think's going to win. And then either, you know, I wouldn't have even really felt that bad if I constructed a suggested ticket where I said make it a $5 or a $4 ticket. Still would have been a losing ticket, but it is a better ticket. You know, my original ticket with Mo Donegal and Ness as the A's. If I'd have made that, taken out the one where I had We the People on top, forget that ticket, and press that original ticket, that would have been a better wager. Still a losing wager. Still a losing wager to not catch that ticket. But it's a better wager. And that's what I wish I was better at. I'm trying to be better at.
No, that's everybody. That's everybody's goal, no doubt. Johnny, let's take a couple of minutes and touch on the other performances. And it's certainly worthwhile doing what we've done. But talk about some places where maybe you leveraged or you had strong opinion and capitalized on it, and then just some overall thoughts about what we saw with some of these efforts. You heard Andy Beyer. You heard John Sadler. Sadler says Flightline, best since Spectacular Bid. Andy says best since Ghost Zapper. You've seen some good horses over the years. Where's he fit in?
Yeah, I've seen some good horses, and I had the distinct pleasure of being a member of the Santa Anita publicity staff when Spectacular Bid was running at Santa Anita. And the Malibu Stakes that John Sadler referred to, I was around for that. I was around the bar with Buddy Delp and the whole crew, and it was really such a magnificent time to be around a horse like that, and to be around people connected with him, who are down in history as characters of the game, and a lot of fun to be around. Also, when Sadler mentioned Spectacular Bid, I thought to myself, oh, yeah, I remember. It was, I used to go down after the race and get the quotes from jockeys in the jocks room. And I was the first person, I asked Bill Schumacher, I kept asking him, each time Spectacular Bid ran, I would ask him, is this the best horse? And he wouldn't really commit to it. And then finally he did. He said, yeah. He said, he's the best horse I've ever ridden. And so, you know, I mean, that man rode some of the greatest horses to ever perform. So when he said that, I knew that this was, you know, that I'd seen a really great horse. And to this day, he's the best horse I've ever seen in person. Spectacular Bid. It's funny because right after the Flight Line race, Bob White tweeted out, it was this handicapper in Southern California, has been for decades, tweeted out that he reminds him of Spectacular Bid. And then Jeff Siegel replied and said, Jeff Siegel's a dean of Southern California handicappers, someone who I respect greatly. He said, yeah, Flight Line's, you know, he's awesome, incredible. He's going to have to do a little more before we hand him the bid title. And I immediately jumped in and said, yes, you know, I agree with Captain. While his stride, he moves so fluidly and so effortlessly, and he covers ground. He's got this great long stride. And to be in the position he was, breaking slowly, and then you know, lets him run a little, and he gets up, and then he checks to check him, and then he moves back up inside, and he's got to grab him again, and he's got to shift outside, and the horse never got rank with him, never started to pull. You could switch him on and off, and that's what Shoemaker, back then, was 79 or 80, I guess, maybe, 79, when Shoemaker said to me, you know, he's amazing because he's got several moves in him, and you can just, he'll come back to you. You just grab him, he comes right back to you. He's so smart, and he's so talented. Not only does he have ability, but he's got the brains. He's got the makeup to not use his energy unwisely. And I think we saw some of that, too, in what happened. We definitely saw that with Flight Line. And then to leave a competitor of the quality of Speaker's Corner, to just leave him, oh, you know, you don't see that. And listening to the show earlier today, when John Sadler was talking about, you guys were talking about, you know, what does he do that amazes you, or when they, and he said, well, the first time he breezed, Sadler was, you know, picked his head up. And I said to Gail, my wife, I said, you know, it must be amazing to have been, to be a trainer for a long time, to have been a trainer for a long time, and to have one work, and the first time they work, you see what you haven't seen in all those other horses, in all those other performances. You see this horse do it so effortlessly and so easily and so fast. And you think to yourself, we finally got one. We got one, you know? And that moment, I'm always interested in trainers. When was the first time you knew? Like in a case with someone like Baffert, he's got a string somewhere else in like Los Alamitos with American Pharoah, why can't I think of his name? Oh, I'm embarrassed right now.
Which, Justify?
The Baffert's trainer at Los Alamitos. I am embarrassed. Anyway, he told Bob, you know, this one, they knew when he was a baby, he could run. But the fact that he he just kept improving and improving and getting better. And then when he sent him to Baffert, you know, they knew. But still, when Baffert saw him work and had the watch on him, and when they see how easy they're going and they look down at the time, it's like, oh, wow. And here's a guy who's had, you know, any number of talented horses. But that moment when they realize we've got one, that's got to be such a great, special feeling. Probably like a coach. You know, let's say you've been coaching, and I make an analogy, you've been coaching football for 30 years, high school football for 30 years, and you got a kid that just shows up, you know, with the rest of the group. He's a freshman, and he's going through drills, and you have a scrimmage one day, and he takes the ball, and he jukes the first two guys and outruns the fastest player in the secondary down the field. And you just look and say, oh, we got one. We got one. You know, it's going to change everything. And that must be an incredible feeling. Anyway, Flight Line, what a performance. And I've talked about it already. Look, the Belmont is the Belmont. And as you said when you started the show, where do you begin? At this point, we kind of begin with Flight Line because, he's had the starts and stops, and that's another part of this game that just, or in sports in general, anything physical. That coach that has that once-in-a-lifetime running back who goes out in the third game and blows his knee, and never is the same again. We have the same thing happen in this sport where you have a once-in-a-lifetime horse, and every morning when you go to the barn, you hold your breath that everything is okay because they're so fragile and things can go wrong, as Flight Line has shown. And they're not career-ending injuries, but they set you back.
Yeah.
You know, when something happens, it's not 2 weeks, it's not 4 weeks, it's 4 months or 5 months, you know. So, that was an exceptional performance. And you're not going to get to see those kinds of horses that often. You're not going to get to see horses that move like that, run that fast, can start and stop and don't get ranked and don't get discouraged or don't. You're not going to see that very often. And we have to realize that when they run and know that we're in the presence of greatness. And I think that was very abundantly clear. And we just have to root for him to continue to run because as fans of the sport, we need to see that more often, you know. We got to see some other great performances, certainly, throughout the weekend. But that one, that's a special one. You got to hang on to that memory.
Well, I'm going to come back, and later in the week, and certainly when we talk to Hammer, I can bring this up with him. But one of the things, and
wait,
you
wait,
actually
wait, Steve, wait. Let my senior moment here. I got to make Mike Marlowe.
Okay.
It gets there. It comes. The word comes. It comes. It takes a little while. Go ahead.
Probably use Hammer for the point discussion on this, but maybe a racing manager, racing director, type of a conversation. But you hinted at it, Johnny, and that is the odds of having every horse that could potentially be on the card make the races when everybody that in anybody's barn has to be ready on this particular date, the odds are just against that. Granted a fixed point in space, is going to be there's going to be whatever odds there are for anybody to have their horse ready to get in the gate. But when you stack all of these races into that same parameter, I'm going to guess that exponentially, your odds of having them all show up is lower. And I'll get back to what I said to either Andy or to Sadler. That Ogden Phipps, if it's the feature next Saturday at Belmont or last Saturday at Belmont, if you had had the New York stake from Friday and the Ogden Phipps as the features, the people would be so excited about the performances and the race. Instead, we're absolutely creating this smokescreen where you say you want to create rivalries, you want to create the horses that people have become fans of. All right, you're not doing yourself any favor this way. It's too much, and it's not necessary.
Yeah, well, this is a development in the last 10, 15 years, maybe, of the big day. It's a marketing thing. It originated as a marketing thing. I don't know the stats. I don't run a racetrack. I haven't looked at the figures about what is better. Is it better drawing, this massive crowd on one day and getting the nation and the world attention and having them pour money through the windows on all these, this outstanding rich races on one day? Or is it better to try and have these separate days? I mean, it didn't used to be this way, these massive days. In fact, one guy said to me the other day, they should move the Met Mile to Memorial Day. I said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I said, they already did that. That's where it was.
Yeah, exactly.
Memorial Day weekend, they should move it to Memorial Day. I said, yeah, well, that's where it was before. But I think racetracks have looked at it, and I guess they have, I don't know, and said, we make more money having these big days than we do having sporadic, Ogden Phipps on a random Saturday. That's the reason they brought all these things together, is to make more money. Now, is that still the case? I don't know. That's the only reason they did it. Excuse me. And the other point that I have to stand up in the face of one of racing's great minds. And it's not true that great minds think alike. Because my great mind and Andy Byer's great mind are not aligning on this topic. The Triple Crown does not need to be changed.
I agree. Okay? I agree.
It's something that, okay, look, this year, even though the Derby, he admitted that the Derby, more people had asked him about the 80-1 shot winning the Derby than talking about horse racing, ever. And I would have to agree with that because I had a lot of people asking, what happened with this horse? How did he win? And what's he doing? Is he going to win the Belmont? I had people asking about that. And it was an off year. It was, look, every World Series is not one for the ages. Every NBA Finals, this one going on now, is not going to go down in the books as one of the greats. When you have events, major events, this one happens to go spread out 6 weeks, much like the NBA Finals, if anyone's following that. But you're not always going to, every day can't be Christmas. You're going to have years when it's like, it still was an enjoyable race. I still found it a good race to handicap. And then you say, well, we don't have many mile and a half horses left. So why do you expect it to be something out of this world? It's going to be the third leg of the Triple Crown. Then it's going to be important, really important. Then you're going to wish you'd bred for a mile and a half when we get to that third leg of the Triple Crown. And the spacing of the races, if your horse is beaten, if your horse runs hard in the Kentucky Derby and is beaten 10 lengths in the Derby, which is not unusual. That's not a big margin in the Derby. Yeah, you're probably not going to run back in the Preakness. But moving the Preakness in another week, 3 weeks, is not going to make your horse any better. He's still got to be 10 lengths by the horse's tongue. You know, you got to beat in the next race. So I don't know that the timing is going to make anything any better, because in the point you just made about everybody arriving on the same day, ready to go, it's just hard to do with horses. You know, it just doesn't work. You know, because they're so fragile and things happen. And you know, look at one of our top class fillies was on the track headed to the gate, and something went wrong.
Yep,
I mean,
that's right.
You know, it's the way it is, and so I think that because of our national exposure to the Triple Crown, the only time anyone talks to me about horse racing, Derby, Preakness, Belmont. You know, it's the only time any civilians, non-racing people, civilians, the only time civilians talk to me about horse racing is during that period. Stretch it out, it's going to lose its punch, it's going to lose its value. And on the NBC broadcast this weekend, you had a segment just before the Belmont Stakes, leading into Belmont Stakes, of American Pharoah winning. And the crowd and everyone cheering and holding up their phones. And Larry Comas, you know, we've waited for, you know, the whole thing. And then we had Justify coming a couple of years later. And everyone talked about how moving and wonderful those moments were, and how, you know, they still bring goosebumps and tears to my eyes. And I remember where I was, and all of a sudden, you go to Randy Moss, let's change it.
I saw somebody else say that. Yeah, that was funny. You're right. That was funny.
Tell me about goosebumps and tears and what a magnificent race it was. And Smarty Jones, look, even the defeats are wonderful. That Belmont with Smarty Jones. I've been to thousands of sporting events in my life. I have never, ever had the air sucked out of an event. That place just crashed when Smarty Jones got beat. The air was sucked out. It was a humid day anyway. But what little air there was, sucked right out of that place. And it was outdoors. And the air was sucked out. It just, and where do you get that rise and fall of emotion leading up to the Belmont? Might have been leading up to the, well, maybe it was the Belmont. I went out to Parks, and Smarty Jones paraded. He galloped.
10,000.
He galloped. He didn't work. He galloped. And yep. I was there that day. And that doesn't happen. It happens because the Triple Crown means something to racing fans, to sports fans, to America. Do not mess with it. You're going to have clunkers. It's going to happen. You're going to have short field. You're going to have Derby winners not run back. Why? One of my best friends in my life, Eddie Gregson, trained Donald Dosol, won the Derby, did not run back in the Preakness. Why? He can't win. He can't win the Preakness. He can't win it. Why would I run him if he can't win? Okay. Why didn't they run Red Strike? Because he couldn't win. It takes a special horse to win the Triple Crown. That's it. A special horse. When you've got a special horse, then you're running all three.
Yeah.
All right, put the soapbox away.
I'm done. Johnny, this was great. I appreciate it. We covered a ton of ground. We got everything in I wanted, and we put this away. It'll take a few days to recap everything. A lot to absorb, but good intro, good way to wade into it. Thank you.
Stevie, I find it interesting now with this live, this golf, this new Saudi-backed golf organization, if anyone's following that, it's called LIV, which is the Roman numerals 54 for the 54 holes they're going to play instead of the 72 holes normal. But it's a bunch of money, and golfers are jumping from the PGA over to this LIV, Saudi-backed money. And, you know, it's funny because horse racing blazed this trail. I mean, first we had Dubai, which was interesting. But then the Saudis put up more money. And because of the political climate, some people don't like to talk about the race or promote it. I don't know if you know any of those people. But it's a real thing. I mean, the political climate in Saudi Arabia on a variety of levels has people concerned. And for that reason, they would not, you know, join this tour. But the amount of money, it's a lot of money. And, you know, it's an interesting dispute going on, and it's interesting to watch how it's affecting golf, just like it affected horse racing. The Dubai World Cup affected Santa Anita handicap. I mean, it killed it, basically. It took it from being one of the ones down to, you know, an important race. It's still an important race, but it's not what it was. And just like the Breeders' Cup affected everything else we do. So things change in the world, and I just thought that it was interesting that we had the same or similar, we'd experienced a similar thing where the Saudis took a lot of money, picked out a date and said, come get it. And now they're doing the same thing in golf. It's interesting. And nobody mentions racism in any of the articles and any of the, no one mentions how it's similar. You know, we don't have a PGA organization, but we have racetracks in the circuit. And horses are leaving our country to go race elsewhere. It's just the way it is, you know, for a variety of reasons. Anyway, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I saw where I saw that Jay. I'm sure Jay actually will later in the week. We'll touch on it. I've made my feelings known. It's an obscenity. So, you know, we've got. We've got our own difficult decisions to make, and racing is somewhat different given the high level of involvement and participation of, you know, particularly, you know, the Maktoum family. It's not just, you know, it's not just a question of hosting the events. Yeah,
there were some flags on that play, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. All right, Johnny, I appreciate it. Appreciate you bringing it up.
All right. That's it for me.
XB. You're done. XB Johnny D, everybody. We got Johnny. We got, let me think. I think we got one more. Yeah, we got one more week before vacation. So we'll talk next week. And then we're going to turn our page and get ready for the summer season, for Del Mar, for Saratoga, for Ellis, for everything that comes with that. So start to shift your gears into summer mode.
What gears I have left, I'll shift.
Exactly. Johnny D, everybody. Let's take a break, our last of the morning. And when we come back, we're going to connect with Kev in Singapore. We'll get the Tuesday and Wednesday opinions for Royal Ascot. And we'll close out the morning with Steve Asmussen, and we'll talk about Clair Yer and Jackie's Warrior, and more. And actually, there's a if you didn't see it, there was a two-year-old. Did you see that two-year-old Friday at Churchill? Unbelievable. Gulfport. Gulfport. That's going to be one to look out for. And while we're mentioning Churchill, as we go to the break, I do have to fit in that piece of news we had mentioned last week when it looked like they were going to essentially cut back the turf racing for the remainder of the meet to two races a day. They're going to cut it back to no turf racing. The turf course needs a chance to knit and to take. I mean, you could see. I mean, visually, it just the thing has turned, you know, sort of this odd golden, this golden brown or whatever. They think essentially they just used it too much and didn't move the fences around enough. So they're going to give it a rest, and if it's going to be ready for that July, mini million thing, we'll have to wait and see. It's already June 13th. It's not like this is a week after Derby. It's 5 weeks after Derby. So we'll see what happens, but it is a difficulty, to say the least. And of course, there's plenty of people who were expecting to run over these last couple of weeks of the meet as well, and they're going to have to, make adjustments. I'm sure Indiana will be a beneficiary. I'm sure some are going to head to Colonial. You got a lot of Colonial, but that's still a ways away. So. Speaking of turf and Churchill, you did have the amazing Michelle Lovell and the amazing Just Might won that mighty bow, and I did sort of hint about Cyberknife. Cyberknife's exciting win over Howling Time. That was good. That was a good race. Good running of the Matt Wynn. All right, take a break. Our last of the morning. We'll get back with Kev and with Steve Asmussen. Stay with us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire. Maryland's 5/8 mile training track completes the full service facilities from the folding barn to the racetrack. Join the excitement of racing with Country Life Farm, where our partnerships can take you from beginning to winning.
Want to get your career in horse racing off to a fast start? Well, the University of Arizona's Racetrack Industry Program is your winning ticket. The Racetrack Industry Program has served as a springboard to some of the industry's most successful individuals, with a proven track record of job placement right out of college. If you want to earn a degree in the exciting horse racing industry, the Racetrack Industry Program can put you in the winner's circle.
Visit ua-rtip.org today.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine?